Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 10th, 2020. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. In today's weather, despite the sunshine that greeted us this morning, showers and thunderstorms will be the story for the rest of the day. It will also be a breezy afternoon with east winds 5 to 10 miles per hour becoming northwest 15 to 20 miles per hour. Winds could gust as high as 35 miles per hour. Chance of precipitation is 80%. Showers will taper off this evening. It will be a mostly cloudy night and then clear with a low around 53. We'll enjoy 15 hours and 11 minutes of daylight today, with sunset tonight at 8:42 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow at 5:31 a.m. On today's front page of the Gazette, Lee Hermiston and Grace King of the Gazette report, protest demands hit the city council dais. After thousands of people have marched over the past few days in Iowa City and Cedar Rapids to call for police reforms, city leaders in both communities took initial steps Tuesday to fashion their response. In a special city council workshop in Iowa City and at a meeting of advocates and some city officials in Cedar Rapids, participants cited an urgency to act now, and yet some said reforms would take time. Iowa City. In the midst of an Iowa City Council work session called to address demands of the Iowa Freedom Riders, Council Member Laura Burgess's frustration showed a bit. Quote, "I feel like we're missing the moment right now," Burgess told her colleagues. "I think we need to focus on things that aren't in the weeds," end quote. Much of the two-hour meeting focused on Mayor Bruce Teague's suggestion that an independent commission be formed to study the protesters' growing list of demands, which for now include dropping all charges against protesters, publicizing the Iowa City Police Department's budget, dedicating a portion of the city's staff to diversity and inclusion, creating an affordable housing plan, not enforcing evictions, restructuring the police department, and divesting from military-grade police equipment. Iowa City already does some of these, and some are outside its jurisdiction. But Burgess said she wanted to make progress on specific items now, not wait for a commission's findings. While she believes the entire council is on the same page with respect to supporting the goals of the Black Lives Matter movement, Burgess said the council was getting too hung up on jurisdiction, authority, and, quote, "what we can do," end quote. Quote, "we can advocate," Burgess said. "That's our role. That's part of our role," end quote. Ultimately, the city council largely agreed on a mix of actions. It plans to send a letter to Johnson County Emergency Management asking the agency to get rid of the county's mine-resistant ambush protected vehicle, or MRAP. The council also intends to review a list of citations and charges written during the protest before calling for any of those to be dropped. Burgess said the other demands can easily be met, such as making the police department budget easily accessed online. Other items will take more time. Teague has called for a commission to listen to the stories and experiences of the protesters and make specific recommendations how to address those concerns. Teague said the commission would be similar to the Better Together Coalition tasked with coordinating the community's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. But it was left unclear who would coordinate that commission's efforts or who would be on it. Other actions discussed by the council include possibly renaming Weatherby Park in honor of Black Lives Matter. Cedar Rapids. An advocacy group in Cedar Rapids is hoping to, quote, "stand in front of the entire city," end quote, by Juneteenth, which commemorates the day the last slaves were freed on June 19, 1865, in the United States, and celebrate progress on their demands with the city of Cedar Rapids. Mayor Brad Hart, council members Dale Todd and Ashley Vinorney, and police chief Wayne German met Tuesday with members of the advocacy group, which had organized a Black Lives Matter protest Saturday night in Cedar Rapids. The advocates had seven demands. After 90 minutes of discussion, the assembled group had discussed only two: forming an independent citizens' police review board and making significant investments in diversity, equality, and inclusion. The parties plan to resume the conversation virtually at 9 a.m. Friday. Other demands include banning chokeholds, imposing strict body camera provisions, and abolishing qualified immunity for officers. German said he would be open to a conversation about a citizens' review board, but there are confidentiality policies to be navigated. He did not know whether those were imposed at the city, state, or federal level. Hart said it would be, quote, troubling, end quote, for people not trained in law enforcement to judge law enforcement. Quote, having some sort of citizen participation in a review, I think, makes sense. Having a panel that's all citizens, I don't think that makes sense, Hart said. German said, as for investing in diversity, equality, and inclusion, the department requires at least an hour of implicit bias training for all its officers. Advocacy group members asked for the police department to consider giving incentives to officers which live in the communities they police and having implicit bias trainers who are people of color, which German said they were not. The goal Tuesday was to, quote, develop a framework for how this conversation continues going forward, said Linn County Supervisor Stacy Walker, who also said he was speaking as a member of the advocacy group. Todd said reaching an agreement by Juneteenth was unrealistic. Quote, I saw your demands. Demands don't go great in some places. Let's think of them as priorities and doable and achievable things, he said. While Hart said he was interested in creating a task force to continue these conversations, Walker said it would slow down the process. Quote, what you're hearing is frustration of a task force and committee after committee, he said. There's a sense of urgency here, end quote. While initially the conversation was heated, Anthony Arrington, who represented the advocacy group, said there was some commonality by the end. Quote, not a lot of cities have the opportunity to look a mayor in the eye and argue, he said. These demands are not a desire to back you in a corner, end quote. In other front-page news, Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette reports, Coralville prison warden retires amid coronavirus investigation. The Iowa Medical and Classification Center warden abruptly turned in his retirement notice last month after higher-ups began investigating concerns that COVID-19 guidelines were not being followed at the prison, records show. James McKinney, who has been in Iowa Corrections for 27 years and at the Coralville Prison since 2015, sent an email about his retirement at 11:58 a.m. May 8th to State Department of Corrections Director Beth Skinner, public records obtained by the Gazette show. The one-sentence notice stated he was retiring that day. Nearly 2 hours before McKinney provided that notice, Skinner sent an email to the IMCC staff saying she had made some, quote, temporary changes, end quote. She announced Randy Gibbs, warden of Iowa State Penitentiary, would, quote, effective immediately, end quote, be interim warden of the Coralville Prison. Quote, this facility deserves strong and steady leadership, she wrote. A number of decisions have been made over the past several months that have resulted in my ordering an investigation into these issues. Quote, I'm looking for facts. If after a thorough understanding of the facts, a change needs to be made, it will be. I owe all of you that much, end quote. She didn't mention McKinney or his retirement in the email. The Coralville facility is the admissions center for all defendants across Iowa convicted and sentenced to time in state prisons. So following coronavirus guidelines would be a priority to prevent any outbreaks in the other 8 prisons. At this point, the center is the only Iowa prison to report COVID-19 cases among inmates. McKinney didn't respond Tuesday to a request for comment. There are between 400 and 500 inmates moving through the center each month who then are sent to other prisons, according to the center. IMCC is a medium security prison and also has the only licensed forensic psychiatrist hospital in the state. An initial statement May 29th from the department to the Gazette indicated an internal so-called review had started that month when a reporter asked if McKinney was under investigation for not following the coronavirus guidelines. Quote, the leadership of this department expects all of our team members to be doing everything within reason to mitigate COVID-19 in our prison system, and will hold ourselves accountable when we have reason to believe otherwise, according to the statement. Quote, in early May, department leadership had concerns regarding the adherence to department guidelines related to COVID-19 and began a thorough review of these concerns at IMCC, end quote. McKinney gave notice soon after department leadership told him, quote, these matters were being reviewed, end quote, according to the statement. The Gazette, in a records request, asked for more details of, quote, adherence, concerns, end quote, and also if the staff had filed any complaints. Cord Overton, the department's spokesman, said communications of leadership are considered confidential under the Iowa Code section that covers internal records from the correctional system. He also noted the department has documents available to the public on its preparations and response to the pandemic. McKinney worked for the Corrections Department almost 3 decades. He started as deputy department director in 1993 and held that position until 1997. He then was appointed warden of the North Center Correctional Facility in Rockwell City and remained there until 2010. After that, he was selected as warden for the Fort Dodge Correctional Facility and remained in that position until appointed in 2015 to IMCC. His salary was $150,705 for fiscal 2019, according to state salary records. McKinney also has been a consultant with the National Institute of Correction since 2011, a member of the Institute for Higher Education Policy's Higher Education in Prison Advocacy Advisory Council, and facilitator of the Liberal Arts Behind Bars program. As part of the National Institute, he developed Leader Dog for the Blind, which helped inmates raise puppies to become seeing eye dogs. IMCC had stopped accepting admissions April 20th from jails to help prevent the spread of coronavirus in the prisons, but the admissions center resumed taking inmates last week, quote, after carefully developing a process, end quote, to reduce the risk of COVID-19. According to the department, IMCC has had 22 inmates and 2 staff test positive. In all the other state facilities, 7 staff members have tested positive. Overton said the department has worked with every jail in the state to ensure inmates coming into the IMCC or the Iowa Corrections Institution for Women have a COVID-19 test administered and the results sent to the admission staff before they arrive. Once inmates arrive at IMCC from a jail, they are held in a 14-day quarantine and tested twice at the end of the quarantine, Overton said. If any of the inmates starts to show symptoms or test positive for COVID-19 during their quarantine, they will be medically isolated, and every inmate in the unit will be considered exposed and remain under quarantine until tested. In the Iowa Today section, Trish Mahaffey reports, bail lowered from $750,000 to $25,000 in CR murder case. A 36-year-old woman charged with fatally stabbing her fiancé is out of jail pending trial after a judge lowered her bail from $750,000 to $25,000. Jacqueline Holmes is charged with first-degree murder in the fatal stabbing of Tremaine Williams, age 35, on March 4th. She bailed out at 10% of her new bail amount, $2,500, with a court clerk Tuesday, as allowed, according to an order filed by 6th Judicial District Chief Judge Patrick Grady. Holmes must be under supervision of 6th Judicial District Department of Correctional Services and cannot leave the state if bail is posted, Grady said in the order filed last week. Assistant Linn County Attorney Jordan Shear, during a May 22nd hearing, asked the judge to leave the bail at $750,000 based on the nature of the crime and because Holmes faces a potential life sentence. Holmes' lawyer, during the hearing, noted her previous convictions were not serious and she has ties to the Cedar Rapids area, according to the ruling. She also has been, quote, generally reliable, end quote, in the past to appear for court. In his ruling, Grady said Holmes has lived off and on in Cedar Rapids, but her closest ties are in Chicago. He admits to finding probable cause that Holmes committed the crime when she was charged, but he added that a $750,000 cash-only bail was the so-called practical equivalent of no bail at all. Shear said he was, quote, shocked, end quote, by the low bail. In his 10 years with the office, he has never seen bail reduce thousands of dollars, and none of the prosecutors in the office had ever seen a judge lower bail to $25,000 for a murder charge, he added. Shear said Williams' family was, quote, upset and concerned about receiving justice, end quote. They are worried about what might happen because Holmes is out of jail. The bail schedule set by the Iowa Supreme Court recommends bail for Class B felonies start at $25,000, and usually that amount is for offenses much less serious than murder. Judges do have discretion on bail, but in recent first-degree murder cases, bail is typically set at $1 million or more. The fatal stabbing happened after Holmes had been playing cards and drinking alcohol with Philip Rogers and others at his home in the 700 block of 8th Avenue Southwest, according to the ruling. Police arrived about 4:25 a.m. and found Holmes sitting over the so-called bloodied body of Williams, who was taken to the hospital and died an hour later. Witnesses told police Holmes became, quote, belligerent. Holmes becomes, quote, belligerent, end quote, when she drinks in excess, although nothing unusual happened when the card game broke up, the ruling states. A search warrant affidavit showed 3 911 calls were made, and on the third call, Holmes spoke with a dispatcher. She was crying and said her fiancé's chest wasn't, quote, rising, end quote. The dispatcher tried to walk her through CPR, but she said she couldn't do it because Williams had a laceration near his shoulder. When officers arrived, they didn't get a response, according to the affidavit. They finally entered from a back door. Williams' body was on the floor, partially blocking the door, and Holmes was partially on top of him. When interviewed by police, Holmes changed her story several times. She admitted to stabbing Williams and then recanted. She then said she wasn't sure if he was stabbed or shot. Holmes also said Williams assaulted her by punching and kicking her in the head, legs, and neck. Holmes has numerous previous convictions for child endangerment, drunken driving, operating vehicle without consent, disorderly conduct, theft in Lynn, Johnson, and Jones counties, and public intoxication, according to court records. She also had probation violations, and her pretrial release was revoked in the 2017 child endangerment case. In other public safety news, Lee Hermiston reports, Johnson County Sheriff's Office identifies woman pulled from Lake McBride. The Johnson County Sheriff's Office has identified the woman whose body was recovered from Lake McBride on Monday. Authorities said Makita Scott, age 21, of Iowa City, was in the lake near a watercraft around 5:31 p.m. Sunday when she went under the water and never resurfaced. The Sheriff's Office searched for Scott until 9 p.m. Sunday, but was unsuccessful. Scott's body was recovered around noon on Monday. Her death remains under investigation, and an autopsy is pending, the Sheriff's Office said. Brooklyn Drazy reports, two troop tubers drown after going over dam on Turkey River. Two women drowned Monday afternoon after going over a Turkey River dam while tubing, authorities said. Sharon Kahn, aged 64, and Vicky K. Hodges, aged 44, both of West Union, went over a dam in Claremont, according to the Fayette County Sheriff's Office. At 3:40 p.m., the Sheriff's Office received a report from someone who heard a cry for help from the tubers. Sheriff Marty Fisher said in an interview, emergency crews initiated a rescue, performing life-saving efforts on the women before they were transported to Palmer Hospital in West Union. They were pronounced dead there. The Sheriff's Office was assisted by Claremont Fire and Emergency Medical Services, Elgin Fire and EMS, Tri-State Ambulance, Gunderson Air Ambulance, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and the Iowa State Patrol. The Iowa Department of Resources warns there are three dams on the Turkey River, including the one in Claremont. Quote, the circulating current immediately below each dam is extremely dangerous, the agency wrote in its online guide to the Turkey River Water Trail. The Iowa DNR counts over 200 low-head dams across the state. Many were built decades ago to create water recreation areas, provide some level of water management, or to generate power. But low-head dams are dangerous to boaters, swimmers, and tubers. Since 1900, they have led to at least 160 fatalities across the state. Rod Boshart of the Gazette reports, Commission approves $3.6 billion five-year transportation plan for Iowa. The Iowa Transportation Commission on Tuesday unanimously approved a nearly $3.6 billion five-year transportation plan. But the plan faces short-term funding challenges because reduced travel and vehicle sales in Iowa during the coronavirus pandemic cut projected revenue. The fiscal 2021 through 25 State Transportation Improvement Program covers road use tax fund investments for aviation, public transit, railroads, trails, highways, and other elements of Iowa's multimodal transportation system. Included was more than $2 billion to modernize Iowa's highway system and enhance safety features. Stuart Anderson, director of the DOT's Planning, Programming, and Modal Division, told commissioners at their informal meeting Monday that short-term revisions could be required because revenue flowing into the state's road use tax fund is projected to decline by $100 million through October, because the coronavirus has disrupted Iowans' travel and vehicle purchasing patterns. To cover cash flow needs and keep construction projects on track, the commission granted DOT authority to borrow up to $40 million from the Reinvest in Iowa's Sound Economy, or RISE, program. The RISE account receives about $50 million annually. DOT officials said significant across-the-board construction cost increases last year forced them to revise many project estimates and limited the funding available for new projects, while a few projects were delayed by 1 year from the schedule identified in the previous five-year plan. However, no projects were removed from last year's program available for highway right-of-way and construction, according to DOT staff. The uncertainty caused by the coronavirus outbreak has been exacerbated by the lack of a federal transportation funding reauthorization plan that counts for a significant share of the highway investments, Anderson noted. The primary DOT investment strategy is focused on the safety, maintenance, and modernization of Iowa's highway system, he added. According to DOT staff, the proposed five-year program includes more than $1.1 billion of investments in Iowa's state-owned bridges to improve their overall condition. The number of poor bridges on the state highway system has been reduced from 256 in 2006 to 39 in 2019, according to the staff report. The five-year plan also focuses on maintaining the interstate system, which connects all transportation systems in Iowa and facilitates the efficient movement of freight in and out of Iowa. Turning now to the opinion section, also known as the insight page within today's Gazette, we'll begin with Liz Lentz's column titled, New Reality in Iowa After Steve King. On June 2nd, voters in Northwest Iowa finally purged themselves of the scourge of Steve King, the Republican congressman known for his greatest hits such as Where Would Western Society Be Without Rape? And How Did White Nationalism Become Offensive? Stephen Arnold King did not just suddenly turn racist in 2018. He has a history of racist comments. In 2002, he tried to make English the official language of Iowa. In 2005, he tried to sue the Iowa Secretary of State for posting voting information on an official website in multiple languages, including Laotian, Bosnian, Spanish, and Vietnamese. Despite this, it was only in 2018 that King received censure from the Republican Party after he nearly lost his reelection campaign to Democratic challenger J.D. Scholten. In 2018, Jewish groups and the Anti-Defamation League called for King's removal from his committee assignments after he met with a far-right Austrian group with neo-Nazi ties. Yet it was only in November that Governor Reynolds passive-aggressively warned King, who served on her reelection committee, quote, I think that Steve King needs to make a decision if he wants to represent the people and values of the 4th District or do something else, and I think he needs to take a look at that, end quote. Ousting the 9-term incumbent was no easy task. It took a lot of conservative PAC money and the full weight of the Republican establishment to shoehorn him from Iowa's congressional delegation. And in response, Republicans have been lauding the move as an act of ridding the party of racism. In a tweet on June 2nd, GOP party chairwoman Ronna McDaniel stated, quote, Steve King's white supremacist rhetoric is totally inconsistent with the Republican Party, and I'm glad Iowa Republicans rejected him at the ballot box, end quote. But while King may be gone, the reality is that racism is endemic among elected leaders in Iowa. It just hides behind a nicer veneer. In December of 2019, Republican candidate for Congress in Iowa's 2nd District, Marionette Miller Meeks, appeared alongside neo-Nazi Nick Fuentes at an anti-immigration event in Bettendorf. Miller Meeks later condemned Fuentes, but not his ideas. As anti-racist protests have spread throughout Iowa, the Party of Anti-Abortion and Family Values has done its best to let us know how they feel about the issue of race. On June 7th, State House Representative Bobby Kaufman, a real hero for brick walls everywhere, broke his silence on the protests to call out via tweet the fact that Kinnick Stadium got spray painted. Kaufman, who offered the so-called Suck It Up Buttercup bill, which was designed to cut mental health services to schools and universities and increase fines for protesters who block highways, was outraged, not on behalf of the lives lost to racism in this country, but for a building which gets routinely puked on by drunken college students during the football season. Just in case you thought this was a one-sided issue, Kaufman's Democratic challenger, Sheriff Lonnie Polkrebeck, who also has been silent about the protests, also chose the vandalism and not the loss of life as his moment to take a stand. Representative Jeff Shipley from Fairfield has been doing his best to act like Alec Jones and Ben Shapiro had a dumb baby. He is falsely accused that no one has died from COVID-19, and in a Twitter thread, he argued it was weak for men to cry at George Floyd's memorial service, tweeting, quote, Did MLK Jr. cry publicly after the assassination of Medgar Evers? End quote. When one person wrote to Shipley to complain about comments, Shipley replied, quote, Are you black? End quote. Eager to fill the vacuous hole of inanity left in the wake of King, Shipley, in a now-deleted Facebook post, praised the congressman and expressed his desire to follow in his footsteps. But it's not just racism. These issues are intersectional. Shipley has also creepily tweeted, quote, "Funny thing, I can really appreciate a woman in a cloth face covering when worn with elegance and sophistication. Can't be giving away smiles for free. Make 'em work for it," end quote. Warren Wethington, Cedar County Sheriff, who was accused of sexism, wrote in a now-deleted Facebook post advising people on how to shoot and kill home invaders. Posted at any other time, it would have been an aggressive call to violence. But during the protests where black people are exercising their constitutional right to advocate for more than just forms of policing, the call is a dog whistle to racists who see black people as criminals. Randy Feenstra, King's replacement, supports President Donald Trump's border policies and was backed by Bob Vanderplatz, head of the Family Leader, which argued in 2011 black children were better off under slavery because, quote, "sadly, a child born into slavery in 1860 was more likely to be raised by his mother and father in a two-parent household than was an African-American baby born after the election of the USA's first African-American president," end quote. It's good that Iowans rejected the loud and vocal racism of Steve King, but what remains underneath is the quieter violence of sexism and racism endemic in our system. We knocked down one Steve King to find that others are rushing to fill his place. And like the mythical Hydra, we cannot just keep knocking down racist heads when we see them. We have to attack the problem at its base. Again, this was Liz Lentz's column today. In today's letter to the editor, Alice Daly of Cedar Rapids writes, "Kinnick Stadium's pink locker room needs to go." In response to reports of racism experienced by former Hawkeye football players, Coach Kirk Ferentz says he is listening and takes responsibility for changing the culture that allowed and perpetuated the demeaning and unfair treatment of black athletes. "While he is overhauling the culture of his athletic department, I hope he will also consider a new paint job for the visiting team's locker room. For the past 40 years, the Kinnick Stadium locker room for visiting teams has been painted pink, and during a 2004 renovation, pink lockers, toilets, and showers were installed. When objections were raised, the excuse was made that the color pink is supposed to be, quote, soothing, end quote. But the stereotypical link of the color with women and the gay community appears to imply that the opposing team is, quote, effeminate, end quote, or, quote, weak, end quote. This is hurtful and demeaning not only to the visiting players, but also to women and LGBTQ people. Belittling others does not show the strength of character that should be demonstrated by an athletic program, and jokes made at the pain and expense of others are not funny. While Coach Ferentz is listening and making plans to upgrade the athletic culture at the University of Iowa, he should include abolishing the pink locker room at Kinnick Stadium. Signed, Alice Daly of Cedar Rapids. Today's Insight page also includes a guest column written by Jeffrey Jones, president of Amerigroup Iowa, and Peggy Huppert, executive director of NAMI Iowa. It's titled, "Breaking the Stigma of Mental Illness in Iowa." We are living in stressful, anxious times. How ironic it is that the social distancing that is helping to slow the spread of the coronavirus has also created psychological distance, which is having an impact on mental health across the country. Amerigroup, together with our parent company, Anthem Incorporated, recently joined with the National Alliance on Mental Illness to recognize National Mental Health Month. This year's theme was, quote, "You are not alone," end quote. The pandemic, while challenging for all of us, can be especially difficult for the vulnerable Iowans that Amerigroup has the privilege to serve. For example, an Amerigroup member in eastern Iowa with developmental disabilities had been receiving services twice a week designed to help her lead an independent and productive life. However, in the middle of March, as the pandemic hit, the program ended. She became isolated, and news reports only increased her anxiety. Amerigroup stepped in to help set up virtual day habilitation services 3 days per week. Now, while sheltering in place, the woman is engaged in online yoga and exercise classes, art projects, games, and cooking, which have provided a sense of normal and improved her emotional health. As part of mental health awareness, Amerigroup launched a campaign to spread the important message of self-care. We encouraged our 590 Iowa associates to compile so-called me minutes, to take a few minutes every day and do something that provides a healthy break, such as taking a walk, connecting with a friend, or just getting outside to enjoy the spring. Together with our Anthem colleagues across the country, we compiled more than 620 million me minutes last month. However, self-care is not a panacea. Mental illness is complex and often requires treatment by a mental health professional. NAMI Iowa, found at the website www.namiiowa.org, is a vital community resource, providing support groups, education, outreach, and advocacy for families and individuals of all ages. If you know someone in crisis, NAMI's information and referral service can be reached by calling 515-254-0417 or emailing info@namiiowa.org. The path to a healthy life does not end with our physical health. Being healthy is about the whole person, including our mental health. We can get on the right path by reaching out and assuring one another that, quote, you are not alone, end quote. Again, this column was written by Jeffrey Jones and Peggy Huppert. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 10, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Adelissa, Dennis McKillop, aged 72, died Monday, June 8th. Henderson Barker Funeral Home in West Liberty is handling arrangements. Aurora, Byron Young, aged 98, died Monday, June 8th. Arrangements by Fawcett Schmidt's Funeral Home in Winthrop. Cedar Rapids, Sandra Zacek, aged 78, died Tuesday, June 9th. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion is handling arrangements. Independence, Nancy J. Karsten, aged 70, died Monday, June 8th. Arrangements by the Rife Family Center and Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. Lamont, Don Sullivan, aged 88, died Tuesday, June 9th. Arrangements by Iowa Cremation. North English, Arlene Weingarten, aged 103, died Saturday, June 6th. Arrangements by Powell Funeral Home in North English. Walford, Thomas Joseph Neuhaus, aged 66, died Monday, June 8th. Arrangements by Hrabach Neuhaus Funeral Service in Belle Plaine. Sheila F. Machart, aged 73, passed away peacefully at her Anamosa home on June 8th. Private family services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, June 12th at St. Patrick Church in Anamosa. Committal at St. Joseph's Cemetery in Prairiesburg immediately after. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations can be given to St. Paul Lunch Program or Hospice of Mercy in Cedar Rapids. The family would like to thank the Mercy Hospice staff for all the help and compassion. Brian Scott Hazlett, aged 56, died May 24th at his home in Del Norte, Colorado. Brian was born August 30th, 1963, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Mickey and Mary Hazlett. Robert J. Aumann, aged 90, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, June 8th, at Northbrook Manor Care Center. Visitation will be 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, June 11th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A private family service will be held Friday, June 12th. Burial will be in Shuiville Cemetery in Shuiville. Helen Teresa Hawker, aged 89, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, June 6th, at West Ridge Care Center following a long illness. Funeral service will be Thursday at St. Patrick Catholic Church by the Reverend Ivan Nienhaus. Burial at St. Joseph Cemetery. Tehan Funeral Home is serving the family. Family and friends must wear a mask and comply with social distancing guidelines when attending a visitation and funeral service. Helen's family would like to thank the staff at Mercy Care for their wonderful and compassionate care. Robert James Oakley, known as Bob, aged 71, passed away peacefully at the Dennis and Donna Oldhorf Hospice House of Mercy on Saturday, June 6th, after a short battle with cancer. A funeral mass will be held at St. Patrick Catholic Church by the Reverend Ivan Nienhaus. Burial at St. John's Cemetery. Friends may visit from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday at Tehan Funeral Home. Instead of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Patrick Catholic Church at 125th Street Northwest in Cedar Rapids or the Hospice of Mercy. Mercy Foundation, 701 10th Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Doris Ann Leonard, aged 82, of Cedar Rapids, died Friday, June 5th at St. Luke's Hospital following a short illness. Private family services will be held Thursday at Tehan Funeral Home. Public burial at noon Thursday at Cedar Memorial Cemetery. Instead of flowers, memorials may be directed to Sharon United Methodist Church. Craig Franklin Howe, aged 66, of Elberon, passed away Sunday, June 7th in his home. There will be a celebration of life at a later date. Memorials may be sent to 141 Edgewood Drive, Tama, Iowa 52339. Overton Funeral Home in Dysart is handling arrangements. Nancy D. Woolwind Cothran of Independence passed away on June 7th at her home surrounded by her family. A celebration of life will occur at 3 p.m. Saturday, June 13th at the Rowley Community Center. In lieu of flowers, please bring a canned food item to donate or make a memorial donation to the Independence Area Food Pantry, one of Nancy's favorite charities. Ella Frances Forbes of Marion, beloved wife, daughter, sister, granddaughter, niece, cousin, and friend, left this world because of an asthma attack at the age of 21 on June 6th at Unity Point Health, St. Luke's. Friends and family may visit and celebrate her life from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, June 12th at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A limited number of people will be allowed in the funeral home at one time. Please plan to wait your turn outside and be respectful of social distancing guidelines. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the family, or please visit the Cedar Memorial website and share a memory of Ella. Robert G. Eggers, known as Bob, aged 70, a lifelong resident of the Tiffin-Oxford area, died Saturday, April 18th at his home of an apparent heart attack. Memorial services will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, June 13th at Grace United Methodist Church in Tiffin, with burial to follow at Oak Hill Cemetery in Tiffin. There will be a time of visitation beginning at 10 a.m. at the church. For a complete obituary and to share a thought, memory, or condolence with his family, please visit the funeral home website at www.gayandchia.com. James Theodore Raftus Jr., age 92, of Robbins, died Wednesday, June 3rd at his home. Private graveside services will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be given to any local hospice, St. Jude's Children's Hospital, or the Shriners Organization. Mary Ann Hicks, aged 91, passed away peacefully Wednesday, June 3rd in Williamsburg. Immediate family will gather for a private memorial. Doris Verla Weiss Heitzhusen of Lucerne, age 97, passed away peacefully on Monday, June 8th at the Keystone Nursing Care Center. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, June 11th at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Lucerne, with the Reverend Dean Duncan officiating. Visitation will be held from 1 p.m. until service time. Interment will be held at the Lucerne Lutheran Cemetery. Funeral services currently are permitted as a spiritual or religious gathering. However, vulnerable or high-risk folks should use discretion in attending. Social distancing and the wearing of masks should be practiced as well. And that concludes today's obituaries. In local sports news, KJ Pilcher reports, sanitize and stay apart is the plan. Marion baseball coach Steve Fish formed a routine during 21 seasons with the Indians and almost four decades of coaching overall. When the Hall of Fame skipper reaches the ballpark, his first stop is the dugout, the sanctuary of sorts for staff and players as they prepare for practice or games. Not this season. The dugouts are off limits in an attempt to avoid crowding and promote social distancing to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Quote, in a weird way, that was kind of hard, said Fish, who has 715 career victories. Quote, so when you're dealing with 20-some varsity kids, you have to spread them down the line and tell them to spread out their bags, end quote. Baseball players and coaches have adapted and adjusted well to the new safety guidelines, and procedures created in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Programs across the state have begun their second week of practice, preparing for the start of competition Monday. Quote, I thought it went well, North Lynn coach Travis Griffith said. Quote, it's really teaching me, coaching staff, and the kids of what our normal is now in a way and what is acceptable and what's not, end quote. Iowa High School Athletic Association Assistant Director Todd Tharp said he was not aware of any programs or players who have tested positive for COVID-19 or have had to be quarantined. The local Department of Health would handle those cases and determine how to proceed. Quote, it's been fairly quiet, Tharp said. Hopefully, that means we've asked about as many questions as we can and have answered them. They're just getting ready to play, end quote. Griffith and Fish haven't had any players sent home due to symptoms or possible coronavirus exposure, which is consistent with most of the Cedar Rapids Metro and Iowa City programs. Quote, we have had one kid miss a practice so far, and that was because of migraines, Griffith said. He didn't have a temperature at all. It was nothing coronavirus related, end quote. Many coaches and players are rooted in tradition and set in their ways. Constant reminders are needed for everyone involved. The emphasis remained on cleaning hands during breaks and staying 6 feet apart. Terms for sterilizing and spacing could join, quote, rock and fire and, quote, grip it and rip it, end quote, in baseball vernacular. Quote, I think I've said sanitize and stay apart more than anything else, even baseball stuff, Fish said. We're constantly trying to remind them to sanitize after drills. That part was different, end quote. Some teams split squads up to limit the number of players on the field at one time. Others have added more stations, having players sanitize their hands each rotation. Fish said this situation is the biggest change he's ever experienced during his career, but the foundation of teaching the game is the same. Quote, baseball was still baseball, Fish said about the first week of practice. Quote, we were able to work on things that we normally would have worked on. It really didn't impact the baseball instruction other than trying to sanitize and stay apart, end quote. The majority of responsibility falls on the coaches' shoulders. They had to record temperatures and inquire about possible symptoms. They also had to factor in additional time for sanitizing during breaks. Coaches also have to take time after practice to sterilize shared equipment. Quote, it's not too bad, Griffith said. When the kids get done raking, they put bats up against the fence by our shed, and then the rakes on the other side of the fence. They don't put stuff away. I'll clean it and put it away. I'll come out and do it beforehand the next day, end quote. Tharp confirmed there have been some changes. In addition to the ban on concessions, team buffet meals aren't allowed, but prepackaged meals are permitted. Also, pitchers will be permitted to have a wet towel with them, providing an alternative to licking their fingers between pitches for better grip. Four schools won't field baseball teams, including Meskwaki, Belmond Clemmy, and Eagle Grove. Players from those four programs will be able to play for any other program with the team if that school will accept them. Quote, we have kids who may be playing baseball somewhere else for the summer and then be able to return back to their school, so they're kind of being three-month free agents for the most part, Tharp said. Schools have to make the decision, do they want a kid from Belmond Clemmy for 2 or 3 months to play baseball and then go back to Belmond Clemmy? Are parents going to be upset if that kid is going to take someone's spot? They have some tough decisions to make in that aspect, end quote. In other sports news, game changer Mary Lee Malmberg retiring at the end of the month. J.R. Ogden of the Gazette writes, Mary Lee Malmberg opened a recent Zoom meeting with some bad news. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, Cedar Rapids lost 19 sporting events and $11.5 million in direct visitor spending. That was bad, but not a surprise. The shocker was second on her agenda. After more than 31 years in the tourism business, about 20 as director of sports tourism in Cedar Rapids, Malmberg announced she is retiring June 26th. Why should you care? Many of you may not even know who Mary Lee Malmberg is. But if you've enjoyed events like the high school state volleyball tournament, quote, that's always near and dear to my heart, she said in a 2015 interview, or NCAA Division III and Division II wrestling championships, no, Mary Lee played a big role in those landing in Cedar Rapids. How about more obscure things, like the 2017 International Juggling Festival or the National Collegiate Roller Hockey Championships? How about the Ladies Titan Tire Challenge, a Simtra Tour golf event held at Hunter's Ridge Golf Course? Those and many, many more were Mary Lee, too. The Cedar Rapids Area Convention and Visitors Bureau in 1999 decided to launch a sports tourism department. Mary Lee volunteered to head the branch and soon after formed a sports advisory committee. I've had the pleasure of knowing and working with Mary Lee for more years than I'd like to remember as part of that committee. She may not know all the ins and outs of every sport, all the X's and O's, but she knows what questions to ask, and she knows how to sell Cedar Rapids. In 2017, she was awarded the so-called Game Changer Award from the Sports and Events Tourism Association. It was a deserving honor and an appropriate name for someone who changed sports tourism in Cedar Rapids. Quote, "I think there are quality of life things that happen when sports come here," she said in that 2015 interview. But don't just take my word for it. Part of her job was connecting the right people with the events she wanted to bring to Cedar Rapids. She has worked with all of Cedar Rapids' sports people at one time or another to make that happen. Chuck Irigoyen, commissioner of the American Rivers Conference, worked closely with Mary Lee on wrestling and last summer's NCAA Division III baseball championships. He noted in an email, quote, "The people of Cedar Rapids owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Mary Lee for bringing major sporting events to Cedar Rapids. She is as genuine and caring as a person can be," end quote. Jack Roeder, president CEO at Prospect Meadows Sports Complex after a long career with the Cedar Rapids Colonels, noted, quote, "She will be missed. I enjoyed working on many projects with her over the years, with my favorite being the 2006 American Legion World Series. Mary Lee was one of the key forces in making that a reality. Mary Lee was a true professional in every sense of the word and had the perfect personality to make it all work," end quote. Angie Cole, recreation superintendent for Cedar Rapids Parks and Recreation, said, quote, "Our memories together are filled with triumphs, defeats, and a great friendship. Mary Lee has done amazing things for our community," end quote. Denny Gettle, retired activities director at Cedar Rapids, Washington, noted Mary Lee, quote, "brought thousands and thousands of people to events in Cedar Rapids that generated many dollars for hotels and restaurants. Mary Lee did a terrific job for the community without ever bringing much attention to herself. Mary Lee carried herself graciously and with that constant smile throughout her work and association with others," end quote. Randy Kretschy, another former Cedar Rapids Community School District activities director, said, quote, "Mary Lee is a pillar in our community. She is an example of what's right in Cedar Rapids and has fashioned an extraordinary career," end quote. Scott Unesh, KGYM sports personality and race director at Hawkeye Downs Speedway, said Mary Lee, quote, "set the blueprint for how to bring in a wide variety of events," end quote. In her final email to the committee she put together, she wrote, quote, "I am very proud of the body of work we have accomplished together over this time," end quote. That feeling, obviously, is mutual. Returning to the news, lawmaker from Coggin hospitalized. Representative Louis Zumbach, a Republican from Coggin, was taken from the Capitol to a Des Moines hospital Tuesday evening after requesting help because he was not feeling well. Zumbach was in a House Ways and Means Committee meeting when Iowa State Patrol troopers were summoned. Zumbach, aged 54, said later that he expected to leave the hospital Tuesday evening. A two-term representative, Zumbach is running for the Linn County Board of Supervisors rather than seeking re-election to the House. In community news, Diana Nolan of the Gazette reports, Iowa puppet troupe Eulenspiegel finds virtual audience during pandemic. COVID-19 blew out the candles on Eulenspiegel's 45th birthday bash planned for March 22nd, but the West Liberty puppet troupe still is wishing to reconnect with people in person later this summer. Monica Leo, the troupe's co-founder, lead puppeteer, and managing director, is looking forward to marking the milestone next spring. Quote, "I'm really hoping for the time when we can have live audiences again," she said. "I appreciate the fact that there are other things we can do. I'm trying to suck as much creativity out of this as I possibly can," end quote. Leo, outreach director Stephanie Vallez, and company have pulled their strings to create free virtual workshops, shows, and study guides on Eulenspiegel's website, owlglass.org. Vallez also has a new show popping up, Kate Shelley's Train Rescue, focusing on a chapter of 19th century Iowa history fueled by a teenager's daring feat after a railroad bridge collapsed. Born September 25, 1865, in Ireland, Shelley and her family emigrated to America when she was 1.5 years old, eventually settling in rural Boone County. Shelley's father worked as a foreman for a crew building railroad tracks, and the family lived along Honey Creek, a tributary of the Des Moines River. A flash flood on the afternoon of July 6, 1881, washed out the timbers beneath the Honey Creek Railroad Bridge, and around 11 p.m., a pusher locomotive sent to check on the bridge plunged into the water. Shelley heard the accident and raced to the scene, finding two of the four crew members still alive. Knowing a passenger train was coming later that night, she ran for help. Along the way, she had to crawl along the Des Moines River Bridge to sound an alarm and get help to rescue the stranded crew. Among her many awards and accolades, a new bridge and passenger train were later named in her honor. Falaise's puppet play was developed for Eulenspiegel's Summer Neighborhood Tour, which typically includes a dozen performances in Iowa City parks. The city hasn't canceled the July and August events yet, so Leah is hoping maybe some of the shows still could go on. Falaise also will be presenting the show at a summer camp in Scott County in July, with the audience split into groups of 15. Leo is developing a show as well, featuring magical fish tales. Quote, I have absolutely no idea when it will be performed, but someday, she said, it's always a good idea to work on something creative, especially in a time like this. Otherwise, the powers of depression start pulling at you. From everything I've been reading, it seems like it's going to be a while before we can do anything in our space, because it's apparently way more likely for this disease to spread indoors than it is outdoors, so I'm hoping we can still do some outdoor work this summer, end quote. The article continues, describing the troop history, and concludes, now 75 and living since 1989 in a log cabin her husband built between Lone Tree and Hills, Leo has been heartened by renewed interest in her art form during her career. Quote, the thing that I've been hearing for as long as I've been doing it is people telling me that it's a dying art, but it's quite the opposite, she said. In this country, puppetry has experienced quite a renaissance in the last few decades. She said it started with the marionette variety shows staged through the Depression-era Works Progress Administration program launched in 1935. Later, Jim Henson introduced a new generation of children to puppets when he joined Sesame Street in 1969. Leo, however, said she was never interested in Henson's Muppet style of mouth puppets. Quote, my parents were German immigrants, and I grew up with German hand puppets, she said. That's more what I'm rooted in, that tradition, end quote. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, June 10th, 2020. I'm your reader, Paula Carresi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. Flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Zofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once-weekly or twice-monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.